Hi, I'm Femi Oke. On this week's bonus edition of the stream, the bonus is a special guest host. Hello, Melissa Fleming from the United Nations. It is so good to see you. Now, as well as being my guest host, you do have a day job. Will you tell everybody what that is and what you do?
Great to be with you and co-moderating with you, Femi. Yes, I'm head of communications for the United Nations, which means I try to get the news out to the entire world in languages people understand and formats that people are accessing for their information. And to get people to sign up to the values that we're trying to promote.
Whenever you appear on the stream, you always come with an issue, a passion that is very important that you want the world to know about. Today is no exception. What should we be focusing on? What do you want to tell us?
Oh, well, you know, we're still a year and a half into the COVID-19 pandemic, and we know that the way out is that everybody in the world has access to the vaccines, but we're not there. So I'd really like to talk about vaccine equity.
I'm going to show a tweet that you shared, and this was a few months ago, where you can already see that you're trying to get that message out. Tell us more about vaccine inequity.
Did you say that was from a few months ago,
yeah,
Femi?
Yeah, it was. I'm going to scoot down here, and then we can actually have a look, see when it was.
So you see,
May 8th.
Yeah, 81% have been given in high-income countries. A few months later, it's still really high. In just 10 countries, it's like 73% of vaccines have been given in just 10 countries. Mm-hmm. That means the rest of the world is really desperate for vaccines. When you take the continent of Africa, for example, only 3% of vaccines have been received by Africans. And, you know, I'm here in the United States, and all the talk is about third doses. And a friend came up to me recently and said, so when are you going to get your third dose?
You know, you would be booster shots.
You would be able to. And it's like someone from WHO said recently, it's like as if you were wearing a life jacket, and the life jacket was just a little bit frayed, but there were all kinds of people around you who were drowning, and then somebody were to give you another life jacket, and the others would continue to drown.
Yeah.
So we need to give those life jackets to the people who need them most, and we have a goal, you know, to vaccinate 40% of the world by the end of the year, and it can be done. It's just we need those who have pledged to share the doses to actually give them, and we need to double manufacturing, and we need much more funding. There's been some hopeful messaging coming out of the General Assembly on that, but you know, we have a long way to go, and people are still dying. 4.5 million people have died from COVID-19 around the world. And it's just unacceptable when we have a way to stop these deaths, not to be doing everything that we can.
All right, Melissa, we are going to get this show started. Thank you for bringing that issue of vaccine inequity to us. We have talked about it on the stream. But today we have a very special program, which is why that you're co-hosting with me, because the stream teamed up with the UN for a few days to talk about pressing global issues. You're about to see, viewers, some of the conversations that we had after the live show, as Melissa would say, behind closed doors. Now, of course, we had to discuss climate change, but I gave guests Mayor Yvonne Akisoya, Hindu Amaru Ibrahim, and Andrew Harper a challenge. What is the best example of climate change adaptation or mitigation you've ever seen?
Freetown the Tree Town. I absolutely love our campaign and our project to plant a million trees over what started as two rainy seasons, but will now be three. But what's so exciting about it is because it's a nature-based solution. It's owned by communities. We are restoring biodiversity. We are contributing to the carbon sink. We are preventing landslides in communities. We are restoring mangroves, and all of this whilst creating hundreds of jobs and really building a sense of community ownership and togetherness as we work on transforming our city.
Oh, didn't even hesitate. Hindu.
Indigenous women that are doing a fantastic project on agroecology, where they combine the traditional knowledge to restore a biosphere reserve around a national park where the planting and indigenous trees, and they are doing an agriculture for the crops down, and during the dry season having a cattle around the place. The combination gives them a revenue and have a great impact into the environment, and it is a best example of how we can build a climate adaptation strategy.
Now, what is the Special Advisor on Climate Action for the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency? What brilliant idea about mitigation adaptation is he going to come up with? Andrew?
Well, it's difficult to follow those two. Right, it's always difficult to follow those two. Like, what we have to be doing is not only looking at mitigating access to energy, we actually have to be changing it to empowering people. If you look at how many people have been displaced around the world, and like it's 90 million people who are displaced. It's no use just looking at cutting off power. We have to provide more power. And the only way which we can do that is leapfrog the use of fossil fuels. They don't have energy at the moment. We have to provide them with energy because that's a cornerstone of empowerment, of dignity, of providing access to livelihoods. So providing renewable energy to not only the 90 million people who have been displaced around the world, but to the hundreds of millions of people who are also in very fragile, energy-deficient areas is not only the right thing to do, it's an amazing opportunity for the private sector, development actors, to establish markets. Because if you give people hope, mm-hmm. if you empower people, they will deal with the rest themselves. Like it's no use just always coming up with a top-down approach, whether it be from New York or from Geneva or from capitals. You have to listen to the people, see what they want. People do not want to move. And this is where what Hindu and Mary Vonnen were saying was so important. We need to support adaptation. We need support preparedness, and we need to empower people. It's got to be a win-win situation, both for people and for the environment.
It was really great, actually. That's my former colleague and friend, Andrew Harper, to hear him and these amazing two women. I think really what they're all saying, I love this concept, and they're all three saying that same concept of empowering people locally, and people do not want to move, and climate change is threatening many more people than those 90 million who are already displaced to have to move and to be forced to move. But there are local solutions, and I loved the planting trees and also the you know what Andrew mentioned about providing energy. So it's not just all preventing and mitigating climate situations, but it's also empowering people to with jobs and livelihoods and energy that is renewable to transform their community. So it's really great ideas here. Yeah. And it's if you look all over the world, it's incredible the creativity that people have and how they can get ready for climate change, how they can adapt to climate change. They just need the resources.
Mm-hmm. And Melissa, what I was thinking, what became very obvious from that conversation was political will is so important. It will get so many things done in terms of global emergencies and global solutions. So how do you persuade governments and policymakers to take meaningful climate action? I asked three climate advisers how they would convey the urgency of the climate crisis to governments. Selwyn Charles Hart got the conversation started.
In 2019, I was in a much different capacity, but I had, I visited the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian. 2019, and what I saw on that island, it seemed as though after a devastating hurricane, it looked as though a bomb had dropped on the island. And quite frankly, if this is the future of humanity, we all better wake up and be bold in tackling the climate crisis. I saw towns washed away, people's entire lives and their livelihoods just gone in a flash, with scores of people still missing weeks after this disaster. We're seeing this all over the world. We need to do everything we can to stop this crisis. And my simple message it doesn't look good. We're off track, but please don't lose hope. We cannot lose hope. We know what to do, and we have the tools to do it.
Co, your story.
I'm gonna tell a personal story, actually, and it doesn't cast me in a very good light. I've been working on climate for over 20 years, been involved with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I was a former climate negotiator in the COP process. And 3 years ago, the IPCC put out a report on 1.5 degrees of warming. What would we need to do to keep warming to that level? What would be the impacts if we were able to hold the temperature there? And, you know, I've been working on climate forever, and it was that report that just woke me up. It was like all of a sudden, these temperature targets are not sometime in the long future. This is now. And it just made me completely look at the way I live my life. I drive my car. I fly airplanes. And it's embarrassing to say it took that, but it really was a report that said, we have to act now. And it woke me up.
And now you're woke. The true meaning of being woke. Nisreen, wrap us up with your story.
I want to pick up from what Go just mentioned. It's not really the future, it's now. Last year, Sudan had its worst flood since 100 years. So a century of floods, but never that devastating. I visited many areas that was impacted by climate change and by floods itself. And all of the stories I was hearing was so coming like deeply into my heart. Not only because we did not cause this, because we did not cause it, but because these simple farmers, these simple citizens didn't know what they are hitting by or what is coming to them. And now I've been receiving a phone calls every 2 seconds asking me, should we like do the farming processes? Should we start the farming processes or we will have a flood again this year? Because for people who doesn't know, when a flood happens, it doesn't only destroy the existing plant. It also forbidding you or the farmer from doing other agricultural process because they need to wait until the water dries. And unfortunately, most of our farmers are very much depending on dry crops like peanuts, like corn and other dry crops, not like rice, for example, that needs a lot of water. So making these very vulnerable communities, very vulnerable area and very vulnerable sector, which is agriculture, for example, ready to climate change, ready with early warning system, with building the resilience of the communities, with stopping global warming at this limit is right. Really what we hope in order to save this planet and to save the humanity.
Well, you know, it's interesting to hear these climate experts actually giving these examples where they themselves even felt that they needed this to wake up, to realize that climate change is happening now. And I was struck by what Selwyn said. You know, this is the future of humanity. We all better wake up. But he also said, and I know, and also Co mentioned, we need to act now because it's not some theoretical thing that's going to happen in the future. It is actually happening before our eyes. And I think so many of us were struck by our own examples. I mean, I was in the West Coast this summer, and it was 115 degrees. I've just never felt that heat. The drought was just terrible. Lake Mead was drying up. A few weeks later, I was in Greece, and people were telling me that they no longer had spring and that their gardens were not growing. And a few weeks later, you know, it was a blaze and wildfire. So I think I'd just like to reinforce, though, what all of the panelists said, and that is we know the science. We're seeing it happening before our eyes, but we can't lose hope, and I think that was Selwyn's appeal. I work with him, so I know there are a lot of very distressed people. There have been studies recently that children are feeling terrible anxiety about climate change right now and their future. we do have the tools and there is a way out.
But
and
Melissa,
so let's, we all need to just
Melissa,
buy them together.
You and the climate advisors were saying that this is very possible. And I just want you to give me a yes or a no, or on a scale of 0 to 10. That urgency at the UN headquarters right now is what? 0 to 10. 10 is incredibly urgent. Where is it?
10.
All right. Good.
10.
It has to be at 10.
We are the High Commissioner has the Secretary General of the UN has called it a red alert for humanity.
Yeah, it's
and
a
I
code
can't even
red
tell you
for humanity.
How many times I've heard that.
Yeah.
Code
I hope
red
we listen.
For humanity, and it's been quoted over and over and over again.
Melissa, I'm gonna move on. The climate crisis is never far away, but I'm gonna take us now to Italy, the home of Chef Massimo Bottura. Now, he is a UN Environment Programme Goodwill Ambassador who is on a mission to tackle global food waste. Here's Massimo explaining how his work caught the attention of the UN.
I start this project on Universal Exposition, and after that, we move to the Olympics the year after in Rio de Janeiro. And this project, they got so successful that we start opening all these refettorio, as we call, this amazing soup kitchen. And the United Nations start watching us because our project is much more than just feed the people in need, but it's about, rescue the food waste that otherwise would be a cause of climate change and help people to have another opportunity in life. So it's save all the electricity, the human capital, the water that takes to produce climate change. So imagine how many goals we are embracing, with this project. So that's why the United Nations, they were so interested in what I was doing. And, we became, and we arrived where we are, and we keep working, we keep opening. And now we have ready New York and San Francisco. We just opened 2 days ago Sydney, and we also have Geneva before the end of the year.
So I'm just wondering, I'm just looking at this picture of you here on my laptop. I am wondering if the United Nations have idea of what they're dealing with. Chefs are legendary, charismatic, a little bit complicated. They have egos. All of this you are throwing at the United Nations Environment Programme. How are they handling that?
I wrote a book that is called Never Trust a Skinny Italian Chef. You know why I gave that title? Because the chefs are taking themselves too seriously. We have to have a little bit of irony. We have to have a little bit of playing jokes and be open and ironic to ourselves. At the end, we are cooks. And that's what it is, when I have to express what I'm doing every day, I say, what I'm doing every day in Osteria Francescana, I compress into edible bites my passion, music, art, fast cars, but also sitting on centuries of history, because my cuisine is deeply Italian, but filtered by a contemporary mind. That's very important, because being nostalgic, you don't evolve. But being critic, you can take the best from the past into the future. And that's our goal. As an Italian chef, I cannot leave all our history on the side.
Well, What an amazing ambassador to fight against food waste, because his project is actually to take the food waste of these gourmet restaurants and turn that waste into, it's not even waste, you know, very edible leftovers into three-course meals for people who couldn't afford it and who are vulnerable and who are hungry. And just to say that, you know, we are increasingly finding personalities, celebrities in all kinds of sectors to help us spread our messages, you know, whether it's peace and security, we have messengers of peace, or whether it's, you know,
messengers
for refugees. Messengers of music. They help us reach more people than we could ever dream of, Femi.
Which
and I know
brings
the example
me.
You're about to raise.
Yes, it brings me. Like when you and I speak, Melissa, we try really hard not to use acronyms, but I'm going to use one now. BTS. I am going to show you interviewing BTS just a few days ago. Your tweet that went out there, it had over 121,000 likes. It was retweeted so many times. Is that your most viral tweet of all time?
Yes, it is my most viral tweet of all time. And actually, the interview on our YouTube channel has over 4 million views. So this is definitely the most viral interview I've ever done as well. But it's for the UN. It's been the social media posts around this amazing BTS appearance at the UN have actually been our most popular posts in the last 2 years.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
So BTS at the UN enabled us to bring people, all kinds of people who never would have thought to click on in the UN website or UN YouTube channel.
What were the BTS
to come to us?
Melissa, what were the BTS army saying to you, just very briefly, because we're almost at the end of the show?
Yeah, you know, what was really wonderful was to see the reaction of the fans, which are called the BTS army, which was really just so full of positivity. And what I loved about it, too, was that they took time, so many of them, hundreds of thousands, took time to comment and not just to say, oh, thank you for bringing BTS to the UN, which they did, but also, I'm going to be the change that they're suggesting. Ooh. I'm going to do things differently. I'm going to learn more about the sustainable development goals. And so this was really wonderful
it was just wonderful
to see. I don't think we've ever seen this kind of engagement and positivity among ordinary
Melissa,
people around
the
world.
We can't talk about BTS without playing them. So I'm going to say thank you so much for being my guest co-host. How would you like to say goodbye to our audience around the world?
Well, thank you to the Al Jazeera Stream audience for tuning in. It's been great to be co-moderating this session with Femi, and take care, everyone.
Thank you, Melissa Fleming. All right, so I'm going to leave you, I never thought I'd ever say this, with BTS and Permission to Dance, filmed at the United Nations General Assembly. Thanks for watching. See you next time.
It's so loud up in you when your heart's just like a drum, beating louder with no way to guard it. When it all seems like it's wrong, say louder out and join to that feeling we're just getting started.
And when the nights get colder and the rhythm starts to fall behind, just dream about that moment when you look yourself right in the eye.
Right, yeah, there's no looking back. There ain't no one to prove we don't got this all right.